Hello, and welcome to episode number 165 of the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and I am joined today by Mr. Bram Stein, author of Web Font Handbook, from a book apart. Bram, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You're in Copenhagen?
Yes, that's correct. In Denmark.
In Denmark, right in the city?
In the suburbs.
Are you in a house, in a studio?
I am in a house. We actually just moved from an apartment to this house. So.
Wow. It's very nice. Now, earlier, before we started taping the show, you were in a very reverberant space. Was that your living room, maybe?
No, it was my new office, which is completely empty because we haven't moved our stuff in yet.
I see. Okay, because, yeah, it sounded like Elvis singing a ballad. It was really deep and reverberant and awesome, but not decipherable. And now you sound really wonderful. You're sitting there with a Bluetooth mic of some kind, I believe.
Yep.
What's the name of your mic?
It's the Snowball.
Snowball. Blue. Yeah. Snowball Blue. Very good mic. Very, very good mic. What do I use? You know, I use something else, but also very good. It's the Rode Podcaster is what I use because it's what my podcasting mentor told me about, Dan Benjamin. Anyway, it's evening, early evening where you are?
Yeah, it's just past six.
Is it dark?
The sun is setting.
Is it dark yet?
No, it's going to take about another hour or so before it gets really dark.
That's nice, because around here at 6 o'clock, it's dark now.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it still feels like summer. It's still warm outside, but the sun knows that it's winter.
It definitely doesn't feel like summer here. It's getting pretty cold.
Do you have a beautiful summer? Like I know my friends in Sweden, the Swedish summer is just this marvelous thing after months of winter. Do you have the same thing in Denmark or?
I think so, but I've never celebrated it. So,
why? Oh, you don't like the outdoors?
I do. I'm not Danish, so I don't really follow the Danish traditions.
Where are you from?
I'm Dutch.
I see. How you ended up in Denmark because?
So I used to live and work in Sweden, and that's where I met my wife. She found a job in Denmark, so that's why we moved here.
Very simple. Now, how obsessed are you with fonts?
Oh, not at all.
Really? That's hard to believe.
I'm quite obsessed.
And when did that start?
That's a good question. I think my background is in computer science, so I don't really have a design background per se. I don't know, like maybe 15 years ago, I had this idea that I could build a web-based ebook reader.
Wow.
And I started building it in HTML and CSS. And I started comparing it with like a real book. And I noticed all these little differences between how the book is typeset and the web. And I just started reading up on typography and trying to figure out how this stuff works. And along the way, I implemented several solutions for better typesetting on the web. So I started with the justification algorithms. And then I moved on to hyphenation. And then at some point, I realized I needed some nice typefaces as well. So I started looking into web font loading.
Web fonts weren't around 15 years ago.
No, it took me a while to do the first two. So I think maybe 7 years ago, I started looking at web fonts.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, and that's when I found a project by Typekit called the Web Font Loader. So I started using that, and then I noticed a couple of bugs in that library. And I proposed a patch for that library, and that's how I ended up at Typekit.
So you work at Typekit now?
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
What's your title there?
I actually just got a new title called Head of Web Fonts.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty pretty exciting.
That's very impressive. Are you going to bring everything in-house eventually? Do you think Typekit will have everything eventually?
Typefaces? Or?
Yeah, there are some designers that obviously prefer to license their own stuff only. Not many.
I would say it's mostly up to the type designers.
Well, sure. But are you involved in the part of the job where you make it enticing for the type designer? Or you're strictly in the designer's the design experience?
I'm strictly in the web font business.
Right.
Me and two others run Typekit's web font service. So we make sure that the fonts are delivered quickly and in the best possible way.
Is Web Font Handbook your first book?
It is my first book, yes. I've written for Smashing Magazine before, but that was just a chapter.
And did you, even though it's not a long book, did you find it, still very time consuming?
It was. It took about a year. It's like the writing took like 6 months, and then there's another 6 months, which I didn't totally expect. The people at the book apart told me about it, but it was still a bit of like, wow, there's a lot more that goes into a book than just writing it.
And a lot that gets left out.
That too, yes. A lot of things got cut, unfortunately.
The thing, when you're an expert, when you're a really deep expert, like you are, it can, sometimes you need an editor just to say, that's really, this extra point is really interesting, but it might throw off the gist of your argument or for the more general reader, right? So it's all about, I mean, there's all the knowledge in the world, and then there's what specific knowledge does this specific reader or this group of readers need? I think that's why I need editors, because I can underwrite and I can overwrite. Very easily.
Yeah, it's great to have a good editor. And I think my editor, Karen Littleland, really did an amazing job.
Well, she loves Type. She's a great editor. I've worked with her for years. And she's also loves Type. And, you know, as you know, so.
Right.
She works at a type company, so.
Yep.
Yeah,
so it was really great to have her because there was a lot of. Things where she just pointed out like this doesn't feel right to me as a person who loves type as well.
Yeah, she's a really good judge. I think really, did you feel supported? I know book writing is lonely. I've always found, even with a great team around you, it's a very lonely activity. Especially if go ahead.
No, I felt supported, yeah. It was very good.
When I wrote my first book, I was used to blogging. I was literally used to getting mad about something, ranting about it with a typewriter, you know, at a keyboard. I said typewriter, I just revealed my age. ranting about it at a keyboard, you know, publishing, and getting feedback immediately, so all within about an hour. So, right, because that's how I started. So to then, you know, where you have maybe months that you're just working by yourself, and then the long process between turning in a chapter and getting it back, all that. It's a lot.
Yeah, I totally understand that feeling. I was tempted to take a couple sections and publish them as blog posts just to get some feedback on it.
Yeah. why did you decide not to?
You're writing a book and the content should be part of the book and not be as part of a blog post, I think. So we discussed it with my editor and Cattell, who heads up a book apart. Mm-hmm. And she said some things yes and some things no. So
she's really good at that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So it worked out.
I know that Eric Meyer recently wrote a book where he literally put everything online as he was writing. And I've seen several other friends who write books do that too. So that model can work as well. Right. Not a book of parts model, but that model could definitely work as well. When I wrote my first book, a lot of it was based on things I'd written earlier on the web that I sort of had gotten feedback on, which made them better. But I thanked the people who'd read them, you know, in the foreword to the book. I thanked all the, you know, some, hopefully all the people. Anyway.
Right.
Did you always want to write a book, or it's just your passion for fonts kind of drove you to it?
I've always wanted to write a book, but I never really knew what I wanted to write about until a couple of years ago when I thought, hey, I'm doing this web font thing, and why not write a book about it? So I bought a domain like 3 or 4 years ago because I thought I wanted to like self-publish it and put it up on the web, and but then I just simply forgot about it or ran out of time. I don't remember quite exactly what. And then I mentioned this to my friend Tim Brown.
Sure, Tim at Typekit.
Yes, Tim at Typekit, and he said, "Why don't you write it for a book apart?" And I was like, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea." So I wrote a proposal, and so yeah.
I'm glad he did that. I'm glad you did that. Today's episode of the Big Web Show is brought to you by HelloFresh. HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers your favorite step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients so you can just cook, eat, and enjoy. You choose your delivery day for when it works best for your busy schedule. You can pause your account for weeks at a time if you have to go out of town, as I sometimes do. All the ingredients come pre-measured in handy labeled meal kits, so you know which ingredients go with which recipe, and it's delivered right to your door in recyclable insulated packaging. HelloFresh offers a wide variety of chef-curated recipes that change weekly. There are three plans to choose from: classic, veggie, and family. I choose veggie, because we're veggies. And the classic gives you a variety of meat, fish, and seasonal produce. The veggie gives you vegetarian recipes with plant-based proteins, grains, and seasonal produce. Very fresh, very tasty. And the family gives you quick and easy meals with all the yum-worthy flavor the whole family will love. Now, what's the overall benefit? That's pretty simple. HelloFresh makes it so easy to cook delicious, balanced dinners for less than $10 a meal. No more time-consuming meal planning. No more time-consuming grocery shopping. Enjoy not having to plan dinner, not spending money on takeout. Enjoy an easy night. And just not worry about gathering ingredients week after week. Pretty cool. I like HelloFresh very much. I love the idea that it comes when it's convenient for me. I unpack very quickly. It's faster. It's not just faster than going to the grocery store. It's faster than having groceries delivered to you. And I have everything I need for my meals. It's pretty great. My favorite meal so far, I'm something of a sensualist food-wise, and so I loved the rapid butternut squash agnolotti. Agnolotti is a homemade pasta dumpling with just butternut squash inside. So delicious. And we made it with a sage brown butter sauce. Ridiculous. It only took 20 minutes to cook. The agnolotti was 5 minutes. And the rest of it was just prepped. Just basically just washing some vegetables. It's easy. I'm not particularly good in the kitchen. In fact, I would say I'm usually pretty bad in the kitchen. And all the little specialty things that seem to be required for some cooking programs, not required here. You basically unpack stuff, you saute, you bake. It's very, very simple. You boil. That's my favorite. Put something on a stove, boil it, unboil it. It's pretty great. So this is HelloFresh. They're fantastic. I like them. You can get, again, vegetarian or classic or family, fast and easy. They're all fast and easy, though. And for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter BWS30. That's HelloFresh.com. Enter BWS30. Thank you. Some of the things I really like in your book, one of the things I love about your book is the mixture of aesthetic and technical, aesthetic and practical. So as an example, you talk about, you know, the aesthetic choices of picking fonts, but then you say, well, what about licensing? Because it's, right, it's not enough to just pick a font and say, that's it. You have to make sure that the licensing works for the application. You want to talk about that some?
Yeah. So the licensing is, at least in my opinion, quite complicated for web fonts because most web developers and designers are used to, like, you get an asset and you can edit it, or like if you have an image, you can edit it in Photoshop, you can save it as a PNG or you can save it as a JPEG. But when you have a font, you would want to do the same thing. Maybe you want to subset it, or maybe you want to convert it from WAF to WAF2. But then there's also this license, which you have to follow, and most developers don't even realize that. And that license can forbid you from doing certain optimizations. So there's a lot of interesting aspects to licensing and web fonts.
What's an example of a font that, like, won't allow you to subset or something? Because I hadn't heard of that.
Actually, most web fonts don't allow you to subset. At least most licenses don't, that I've seen. There are some foundries that do that. I can't think of any particular font off the top of my head, but
I know that Heffler lets you, and it, you know.
Yeah, they let you, but they let you do it through their user interface and through their web font service, which is a great solution to that problem. But if, let's say, you go to myfonts.com or something like that, you buy a font there, you download it, and you get a bunch of font files and a license file usually. Most often, that license file forbids you to modify the files that you get.
Right. I mean, there aren't font police yet.
No.
I would venture to, you know, when I started using Photoshop, many years ago, almost everyone I knew had stolen their first copy. And after that, they bought it. Right. Most people bought it once they started getting work, but they stole their first copy. And I wonder, do you know of any statistics how many fonts get, you know, maybe purchased and then self-hosted in a way that technically violates the license?
I don't have any numbers because it's very hard to keep track of individual font files. But I imagine the number is quite high, and it's also very often that like a designer sends his work to somebody else and includes the font files.
This happens all the time. People send you a logo where they're using a typeface, and they don't convert it to outlines and, you know, really set it. It's just a font in there. So they send you, and then it doesn't render, and you say, can I have the font?
Yep.
And they send it to you, and, like, that happens all the time. You think this is mostly marketing people, not designers, doing a lot of this stuff, right? I mean, it's
correct. Yeah.
And even when I work with people who know what they're doing, it's amazing how many times they'll send me just a font, you know, instead of an outline. Let's talk a little bit about rendering quality, because you can get spoiled by your operating system. Would you agree? And then, like, you could get you might have an operating system where, say, Helvetica looks really good. Maybe you have Helvetica Neue, it looks really good on your operating system, and you use it, and then you don't test on some older operating systems, and you look, and it's horrible.
Right. Yeah, that's a very common problem.
What kind of advice do you give in the book for making usable font stacks?
Well, it's actually really simple. You just need to test in all platforms that you support. There's really no way to predict which font you'll actually get. A lot of the fallback fonts are aliased on certain operating systems. So even though it might claim to have Helvetica, maybe you'll get Arial, for example.
Right.
And sometimes you might be, or your customers might be on a system that has Helvetica, but maybe an older copy of Helvetica. And that could also happen. Or they could have installed a newer version, which has slightly different characters than the version that you have on your system. So it's really, really hard to predict what you will get if you use fallback fonts.
In terms of performance, I have this fantasy where on certain systems, I send the user their own system font. They don't download anything. And then on other systems, they get a web font. So, for example, a Macintosh user might get Palatino, their own Palatino, and not have to download anything, right, because their Palatino looks really good. But then on another system, a web font would take its place. We don't have any way currently of doing something like that, correct? Much as
That's correct. Yeah, there's no way to say this is system A with a good Palatino and this is system B with a not so good one.
Even when I know Medium uses system fonts and sets the font stack, so if you're on a Macintosh, it will get San Francisco. But I don't. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know this thing they're doing so that certain, I guess, navigational text is set in a font you already have on your machine. But I don't, as far as I can tell, the only way to do that would be with JavaScript and, do you know what I mean? And sending different styles to different devices, which we kind of want to avoid.
Yeah, you would have to detect which device the site is on, or the user is on. And then sends a different font stack, which is not a great. That's the kind of thing we're trying to get away from. So,
let's talk about performance. One of the things sometimes usability advocates or simplicity advocates or brutalists or just people will say, I don't use web fonts because nobody's ever said to me, gee, I wish this were in a different font. Nobody's ever said, I need that content to be in Geometric Sans. That's kind of a silly argument, but people make it. And it takes too much of a toll, and it takes too long to download. And what do you say to people like that? How do you get them onto the path of optimization versus the path of no fonts?
Right. So, first of all, I do think that in some cases, it is totally acceptable to not use fonts at all. For example, for many, many years, Amazon, like the Amazon.com website, did not use web fonts because they thought it was too expensive to use them. And they actually measured it, and like page load was delayed by a certain amount of milliseconds that directly impacted their sales. So they didn't use web fonts, and that's fine. But in most cases, you can load web fonts in a way that doesn't impact performance, and then you can have performance and your web fonts.
What do you do? How do you advise people, or what do you say in the book about when two fonts technically are the same font size, but they have different, very different X height, they render very differently, and they're on different operating systems, so that, you know, you're making a design, a branded design, but the, for whatever reason, your font of first choice isn't available. So the person gets a very, very, you know, so suddenly like the letting and everything's completely different. How do you advise about that? About that, you know, dealing with fallback fonts that are the same size, but not really the same size.
Right. To explain that, we need to talk a little bit about font metrics. And so each font or each character in a font is drawn inside a little box called an EM box. And it's kind of up to the type designer how big or small they draw the character inside that box. And so some fonts are slightly larger and some are slightly smaller. And that's why even though you set type at the same size, they might look smaller or larger.
They might also have very different line height, even though you set them all to 1.2 or 1.5, they're going to have different looking line height because one has long descenders and another has short descenders, for example.
Yeah, correct. So one way to deal with that is to look at the X height, which is kind of the body of a character. So you have the body and then you have the ascenders and the descenders, which are like the things that stick out from the body and above and below. And if you you try to size the fallback font to the size of the web font and try to match the X height, so the body of each font to each other, then like switching between web font and fallback font will be very minimal. For most fonts, of course, you have exceptions.
Such as?
Like super condensed fonts or super fonts with a super large X height or a super low X height and stuff like that. So sometimes it's just really hard to find a good fallback font for a web font that you want to use. And then you have to accept that either the text is going to be hidden for a couple seconds or people are going to see a fallback font that doesn't match until the real web font does.
Currently, if load times are really slow for whatever reason, let's say a poor connection, do all browsers have the flash of unstyled type, right, fout, or do some have no type at all still?
All Microsoft browsers show you fallback fonts, so the flash of unstyled text.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of browsers use the flash of invisible text, which is where they hide the text while the web fonts are loading.
Have you ever seen a web page that had where the underlines would load? Right, and maybe some subheads would load, but the body text wasn't loading and it just looks crazy, like it's a terrible error.
Yeah, that happens a lot. To me.
What do you have workarounds for fout? Flash of invisible text, foit. Sorry, fout, yeah. And foit and foist. Foit.
Yeah, I hate those acronyms, but we're unfortunately stuck with them.
So foit, flash of invisible text, which seems like a worse problem. I mean, type sort of pixelating into something else. At least you can start using it right away, the thing that the Microsoft browsers do.
Yeah, that's what I'm also advocating for. I think it's more important that people can read the text and that they can read the text in the correct font, but several seconds later.
Doesn't Mozilla also, Firefox also give you the original font and then, or no?
No, they also hide the text, yeah.
So Firefox and Chrome and Safari Opera, yeah. And Opera.
Yep.
Is Opera big where you are?
Not that I know.
Portable and phones?
You mean a Mini?
Yeah.
No, I would say most people are probably on Chrome.
Do you worry about Google becoming what Microsoft used to be?
A little bit sometimes, but I think they do some of the same things that Microsoft did in the past.
Good things or bad things?
questionable things.
Like AMP?
Yeah, yeah. That was actually the thing I had in my mind.
Me too. The goal is, let's stop burdening users with these slow, self-indulgent websites. Let's make everything faster. But instead of saying, so learn how to do good page loads and learn how to write good HTML and learn how to avoid bloat in the way you use resources, instead they're saying, so use this new language that we made up that's kind of like HTML and forget the standard. And then we'll host your stuff on our server and it'll load faster and it'll be higher up in our search engine because you used our thing. We're not a monopoly. No, we're just concerned with the user. I mean, I use a different search engine. A lot of my friends use different search engines, but I think like 90% of the people use Google as their search engine, and 90% of advertising online now is Google driven. And that's a tremendous amount of power.
Yep.
And even if they're trying to do something good, it can be bad, right?
Yeah, it's a noble goal. And yeah. I mean, I could even accept the subset of HTML that they advocate. But
yeah.
Like ranking something higher in their search results because of it, even though you might have a site that doesn't use AMP but is just as fast. So that's the part that bothers me.
Yeah, so ranking something because of it's got good performance, which they can measure, that I would buy. That would be okay. But yeah, they'll say, well, it takes a tenth of a second more to measure it for performance if you're using your own HTML. And it's just, if you're using AMP, we know it's fast. So, I mean, there's a rationale for what they're doing. And in that tenth of a second we save, multiplied by our billions of users, we have overall faster results for everyone, so everyone wins, and what are you complaining about? Kind of, I would say, would be their argument, but I disagree strongly because I like HTML and I like standards, and I worry. It seems like it's always a struggle to keep people sort of focused on that. Do you know the history of where you work? Like, do you know about Jeffine starting Typekit and all that stuff? Do you guys sit around the fire and talk about the old days? And
we do sometimes, yes. So, yeah. I joined Typekit just after it was acquired by Adobe.
Okay.
And, but I was actually interviewed by Jeffine. So.
Okay. Very, very smart guy.
Yeah, very interesting interview questions.
Really? Like...
He was mostly concerned about my height, since I'm Dutch. He wanted to know how tall I was, because he wanted to be the tallest person on the team.
See, I'm 5'5", so we never had that conversation. I didn't even know that was a thing for him.
I don't know.
Really? No, are you also very tall?
Sorry, I'm 6'3", but he's taller, so he was very happy.
Like, I think he's like 6'7", or 6 or more, maybe.
Yeah, he's very tall.
Yeah. Yeah. That's now I feel insecure because I'm so tiny. But I'm wide. I make up for the shortness with width. So that's what makes me happy. I have to take a short on this note of complete insanity. I have to take a short commercial break. Hang in there. We'll be right back. But first, Bram, just hang in there. Here we go. Are you looking for great talent for your business, but you're short on time? Sure you are. I know I am. If I need somebody to work with me, they have to be really good. But I'm always busy, and I never really have time to devote a week or something to a search. Well, you don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. So you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by all the right candidates. Then, ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. You can even get a head start on the interview process by adding screening questions to your job post to help identify the most qualified candidates, so you don't have to waste time sorting through a stack of resumes to find the perfect fit. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And the very easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish all in one place. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter's been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, Big Web Show listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Yep, free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. All one word, obviously. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. Thank you, ZipRecruiter, for sponsoring The Big Web Show. And now we're back with Bram Stein, author of Web Font Handbook. Bram, Indra Cooperschmidt wrote your foreword.
Yeah.
How did that occur?
So I knew Indra from a couple of type conferences I went to, and also from a Slack group that we're both in. And she's great.
What's the name of that group?
It's actually run by Tim Brown. It's called a Nice Web Type Group, where he collects people who are into web typography. And we have like engineers there, we have designers there, we have people who work on the web browsers themselves.
That sounds fantastic. What's the URL for? Can anyone join?
I think it's invite only at the moment.
Okay, never mind.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I think it was Karen who proposed that Indra write a foreword, and I immediately said yes to it because I thought it was a great idea. And she did a great job. I think she made a really important point that, which I didn't really mention that much in the book, is that there's a lot of other things that could affect your performance.
Such as
large images, tons of JavaScript.
Sure.
And that web fonts are not the only thing that you need to worry about. I think it was a really nice touch in the foreword there.
Let me ask you something. Let's talk about some things that are coming down the pike, things that are futuristic but already here, like service workers and turning your website into an app, basically, through service workers, something that'll work offline. How does offline first play into something like web fonts, which by their name have to be downloaded and installed? How does that work?
Right. So if you're using a service worker, I always mix up web worker and service worker. So then you can cache any asset using the service worker, and web fonts are no exception. So you can put it in your special service worker cache, and then they will be available offline as well.
So when I'm reading the New York Times offline, how much of that is system font and how much of that is branded New York Times fonts cached by service worker?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't usually read the New York Times, and I haven't looked at their offline.
What do you read?
Yes.
Guardian?
Yeah.
Good paper? Yeah, it is. I read them all. I'm too scared not to.
It's good to spread your information.
What's
from
coming?
Different sources.
Yeah. What's coming down the pike for the future of web fonts? Are we sort of done? We're like, oh, okay, we solved fonts, we're done, or is there a lot more coming?
There's a lot more coming. And every time I think it's done, then there's something new coming. So there are two things that I'm very excited about. One is the font display descriptor, which lets you actually configure whether you want the flash of invisible text or the flash of unstyled text. So that's going to be great CSS feature to have.
And is that coming to all browsers?
I hope so.
Who's working on it right now?
I know Chrome has it right now, and which means Opera will get it very soon if they don't already have it. I know it's behind a flag in Firefox, and I know that the person who works on font loading in Safari just implemented it a couple days ago.
That's cool. Are they allowed to, they don't ever announce anything though like that, because that would be too transparent. But
no, but WebKit is like an open source project, so you can actually see what's happening there, and so that's how we know that it's going into Safari soon.
I've always thought that was an interesting clash of cultures, right? That WebKit was open source and they went with that for Safari. And for a while, I don't know if you remember, there was a guy, Dave, an engineer who had a blog called Surf and Safari, where he'd talk about what they were working on next and, you know, what CSS property, what JavaScript bug they were aware of, the things that Apple doesn't generally talk about with its products.
Yeah. I do think Apple has become a little bit more open in the past couple of years. At least I noticed that I meet more Apple people at conferences, and they more openly talk about what they're working on.
That's great. Don't get me wrong. I love their products and can't wait to buy all of them. I'm totally addicted to their products. I think they're brilliant, and everything else makes me sad. There's only like one or two other things in the world, I think, like a Rolex watch or something. They're of a caliber that's in terms of design, most of the time it's fantastic. Although the notch, what the hell did they really do?
Yeah.
What is that? Come on, that just like that's just bad. It's like, make the screen smaller, have a little bit of black at the bottom that's uniform. I don't know, it just seems like a bad idea to me, because that means when you're watching a widescreen movie, there's going to be a notch right over just a part of the screen all the time, right?
Yeah, that seems like a really weird decision.
I just keep thinking they didn't do that. I keep on... I hope I don't alienate too many people. When Trump was elected, I went back to sleep, and I went, I'm going to wake up and this won't be true. I was very sad. And still,
I had the same experience.
Well, I have that... Now I'm having on a much, much less... existential degree, of course, I'm having that same thing with the notch. It's not that I'm even buying the phone yet. It's that Apple made a phone with this notch, and they're like, this was the best we could do. We kind of didn't really solve this one. It's a notch. You'll get used to it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, no, that's not what you folks do. So
yeah, and it seems like the way it adapts to a web page is also a little odd. You can either have it like a little viewport outside of the notch, or you can have it like the notch overlap your content.
Yeah, that just seems like when you go to a theater and there's a really tall person, like you. Like, I go to a theater 5'5", and in front of me is Bram Stein, 6'3", sitting right in front of me, and I'm sort of like looking over your shoulder a little bit, and the whole time I'm watching this, whatever. You're the notch. You're the notch, yes, for me. Which is just like you being there, that's cool. We're both in the theater together, that's great, I have no problem, God bless. But a notch on a phone, no, not so much, I just don't get it. Okay, yeah. Well, so the first thing that we talked about future-wise was the font display descriptor. Did we talk about anything else that's coming? I think there's something else coming, surely.
Oh, yeah. So the other big thing is something called variable fonts.
Yeah.
Which will let you... Yeah, I always have trouble explaining what they are. So basically, when you have a regular font now, you can have it in a regular weight, you can have it in a bold, you can have it in an extra bold, and a black.
And each of those is a separate font file.
Exactly.
And you have to decide whether, you know, you're going to use them or not.
Yeah. And a variable font is just one font file with all of those variations built into it and many more.
And it's not an equivalent weight to all those weights. So like if you had 10 font, if you had 10 font styles that you were using on the same page, not that you would, that's 10 fonts in traditional fonts, but it's one font with variable fonts, and it doesn't weigh 10 fonts worth of fonts. It's just a little bit more than a regular font because it's all math. So it's like SVG, or it's like fonts. Right, instead of treating fonts like pixel files, we're treating them like the math that they are.
Yeah.
And we're saying, hey, browsers are good at math. Fonts are good at math. Let's do some math.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Harry Potter movies, the late ones? Did you see those?
I have to admit that I've never watched a Harry Potter movie.
Okay, so you know the font Knockout? Of course you do.
Yeah.
And there's like 50 weights of Knockout. And so in the Harry Potter movie, there was this newspaper, but every headline was set essentially in a different weight of Knockout. So compressed, condensed, extended, black, light, you know, there were every possible combination. And they were really good art directors, so they didn't look like Drek. It actually looked good. You could do something like that on a web page with one font.
Yes, with one variable font.
One variable font. I think that's thrilling. And it's going to change everything.
It's going to change everything. And not just for performance reasons. Like, it's going to be, like, instead of 10, you have one font file, which is going to be a great optimization. But there's also a lot of possibilities for, like, tweaking what you want. So maybe, like, the default bold is slightly too bold for your taste, and you can kind of tune it a little bit down to exactly match what you want.
Absolutely. You've written about this on Typekit, or Tim has, right?
I think Tim has, yeah.
Yeah. Like showing a responsive lettering example from Eric Van Blokland. I always say that wrong. Eric Van Blokland. I try to pronounce it like I'm a European, and it's just sad. But it's wonderful, wonderful creative possibilities.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what people come up with. It's going to be hopefully a period of experimentation.
We also had Nick Sherman wrote on the List Apart blog, I guess, 2 years ago about this, because he knew it was coming because of where he worked. So
yeah. Well, and he's also one of the people who has been pushing for it for a long time.
Yes, he has. Brilliant guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Great guy.
I used to share an office with him. So, and I miss that. And he spends the little money that he makes, because he's really an artist, so I think he could be a wealthy type designer, but he chooses not to be. He chooses to just do his thing. But he spends his money on pizza and on ancient type specimen books, like 1912 German typeface book. Like, there was like a shrine to type, his office. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah, I'd love to visit it sometime.
Do you do that also? Or are you like a collector, kind of an obsessive collector of this stuff?
A couple of years ago, no, but I sort of started collecting type specimens and other type-related books now, so I guess I'm becoming that as well.
You have to. I think people are going to expect it of you now.
I guess so.
Today's episode of The Big Web Show is brought to you by VideoBlocks. VideoBlocks is the place to go for studio-quality stock footage, audio, and images, all for a fraction of the cost. All content's royalty-free, so you can use it for commercial and personal projects. Download all the stock media your heart desires from their member library, including 150,000 videos and 100,000 audio clips. New content is added regularly, so there's always something fresh to download. Now, maybe you've been in a situation where you needed a quick soundbite or video or image. They're hard to get. You have to pay a lot of money for that stuff. We all know everything just is copyrighted these days, and you can get in trouble using something you don't have absolute permission to use. And it's hard to know for sure. I've been in a situation where I took a picture of a building, and it was my own picture, and I wanted to use it, and then I was told that images of that building are copyright to the building's owner. Crazy. Absolutely crazy. Doesn't make any sense. But I didn't have permission to use my own photograph. In another situation, we needed a nice inspirational sky background for a client project, and we wanted it to be moving, a sort of moving hero background. And the cost was astronomical at the usual places. But if you go to VideoBlox, you can get really beautiful quality footage, all for the same low price. You pay once, and it's for the whole year. You pay not very much money at all. It's good for the whole year. And you can just keep downloading footage, audio, and images all year long. In fact, maybe you need something crazy like the Statue of Liberty. Again, that is a tricky thing to get. There's all kinds of rules about it. But if you go to VideoBlox, you can download image or even motion video of the Statue of Liberty, use it in your project, and know that all the clearances are taken care of. It's already. You're protected. You're good. You've got good-looking footage. It's not out of date. It doesn't have an ugly watermark on it. It's all good. So to get all the stock footage, audio, and images you can imagine for just $149, go to videoblox.com/bigwebshow. That's VideoBlocks, VideoBlox.com/bigwebshow to save on millions of studio quality clips, tracks, and graphics from VideoBlox. VideoBlox, the place for studio quality stock footage, audio, and images for a fraction of the cost. So, what's your situation in terms of working with colleagues who are mostly on the West Coast of the U.S.? How do you do that when you're like 10 hours time different?
It's about 9. Oh. So the TypeKit team is very spread out. Or there's some people in San Francisco. There's some people in Seattle. There's some people in Ohio, some in New York. So we're quite used to being distributed. But I'm kind of the furthest out. And I just sort of adapt a little bit my day. So I have my evening in the morning, for example. Mm. And then after dinner, we have our daily stand-up at 7, which is in like 15 minutes from now.
Oh.
And then we usually have a couple of meetings during the evening. And I work until like 11 or 12-ish.
Do you have kids?
One, yeah.
How does that work?
Actually, it works really well. So I get up in the morning and I help get him to school. And I usually pick him up from school before like my workday starts.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And also when he's sick, he just stays at home with me and And my wife comes home and she takes over and I go to work. So it gives me a lot of flexibility, actually.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
What's his name?
His name is Alex.
Alex. Very nice. How old is Alex?
He's about to turn 6 in 2 weeks.
So. Oh, what a great age.
Yeah. He's a lot of fun.
Yeah. They are. They're amazing. Well, I'm very happy for you. If I were a business person who met you on an airplane and I said, what do you do? Right. I just got finished telling you that I sell shoes. And then I asked, what do you do? What would you say?
I always lie.
Really? Okay.
Most people, or I would say normal people, maybe that's a strange thing to say, but they just use fonts in Word. And so the idea that you could base your entire career around putting fonts on the web is a little alien to them.
Yeah, I imagine.
So I either explain to them that, like, when you use Word and you select a font, that's like there's millions of them, and people want to use different ones, and they want to use them on the internet, and I put them on the internet. So that's one explanation, and the other more technical explanation is that I run the web font service for Adobe.
They know Adobe.
They know Adobe. Yeah, for Photoshop.
Yeah, everybody knows Adobe. Photoshop is a verb now. Kids use it.
Exactly.
They use it when they're doing something on their phone that has nothing to do with Photoshop. Right? It's just what we say now.
Right. But yeah, it's sometimes hard to explain. I've had this problem in the past as well. So usually I just say I do applied mathematics.
And you've done type design yourself?
I've dabbled, but no, nothing official.
So how much of your job involves like testing web fonts before you accept them?
Stuff like that. There's an entire team doing that. So they look at the quality of the submissions that we get, and also to see if it fits within our library of what we already have. Like if it's very similar to something we already have, then we might turn it down. So I don't necessarily do that. I do a lot of browser testing. So whenever we release a new feature, I go through all the browsers that we support and make sure that it still works. And that goes back to like IE8 now. But,
wow.
Well, you say wow, but it was like, I think it was last year that we dropped support for IE6.
I hear you, because there are companies out there with tools that they spent millions of dollars on that were optimized for IE6. There was those years that IE6 never changed, and I think businesses thought, and it never will. We can build our whole corporate structure on this thing. What sites do you like for fun, just as fun?
Fun. I read Typographica a lot, Fonts in Use, if I need any inspiration.
Of course, good.
There's a couple of blogs. I forgot the name now. The Alphabets. It's a group of female type designers, and they have really interesting articles.
There's a nice Twitter group of women type designers as well. Where was that? I just subscribed to that. Do you have a list somewhere that you could share with listeners?
Yeah, totally. I could do it. I'll send you that.
You'll email me that after the.
Yeah.
Perfect. That will be fantastic. Okay, you're getting near your stand up. And I'm getting near the end of the episode. I want to thank you very much, Bram Stein, author of Web Font Handbooks, for coming on the show and for writing this book. And thanks for what you do every day at Typekit to make typography more accessible to designers and the people we serve. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.